afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you are listening to Financial Survival. The second and third segment today, I am pleased to have my conversation with James Corbett. So we're going to welcome back James Corbett from his holiday. You know, when Japan did their celebration for their new emperor, he says, we're out of here. They did not want to be around with all the hoopla and everything. So it was a real pleasure to have James back. And, you know, when I do programs with James, it sort of takes me a little ways back. You know, I kind of think of when I did all those programs for so many years with Bob Chapman three times a week. So, anyway, second and third segment, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. And today, yes, I forgot to tell you what day it is today. It is Friday, May 17th, 2019. And thank you for joining me today. So yes, I got my 20 minutes of fame today. So first, let's get started right away and get to the market report. And yes, gold was hammered once again today. Gold and silver slowly making a recovery by a few bucks. You have gold right now down $870 in the New York spot price after market at $1,278.70. Silver, $1,450. It was down 13 pennies. Platinum was down $17 at $821. And palladium was down 18 at $1,323. So that could only mean that the dollar is stronger, and it is up 0.15 at 97.98. Crude oil was down 11 cents at 62.76. The Dow is down 99 points at 25,763. The NASDAQ, 7,816, down 81 points. The S&P, 2,859, down 16. You know, there wasn't really, again, it's all about the tariffs. I guess China has come back out and said, well, you know, it's off again. China's tough rhetoric leaves trade talks with the U.S. in limbo. And we started to see a reversal in the paper markets. So, you know, China is getting a little more tough on their talk when it comes to the trade. So we'll see what happens. You know, China, again, is saying that the U.S. is bullying behavior. And, you know, but what they did do today, China, but they've done it three times before. Let's see if I can find and it's the same week that we had President Donald Trump announce increases on tariffs against Chinese goods. Chinese buyers dropped orders for 3,247 metric tons of U.S. pork, the biggest cancellation in more than a year. This cancellation came during the week ending May 9th. This is a blow to the $6.5 billion export market for American pork that is vital to the U.S. meat industry. So, you know, prior to this trade war, you had China and both Hong Kong that were combined, were the second largest export market for pork, for U.S. pork. The U.S. farm sector, of course, we know has been among the hardest hit by the trade war between the world's two largest economies. Let's see if there's anything else. And again, it's difficult. China does. China is the world's top pork producer. In neighboring Vietnam, the government said it's going to mobilize its military and police forces to combat an outbreak of the African swine fever, which kills almost all pigs that are infected. So, you know, you might be seeing some rising prices for your pork, for your little piggy meat. But anyway, I did come across, and I like Michael Snyder. And, you know, we've been talking about the farmers. We've been talking about their suicide rates are increasing. We've been talking about the flooding, how devastating that is. And he came up with some really good numbers today. He pulled them all together. And He says that when he heard this, he couldn't believe it. So he did a little investigating, and it turns out that the number is 100% accurate. Only 30% of U.S. corn fields have been planted as of Sunday. I mean, that really is an incredible number. You have corn farmers that are up against a wall because crop insurance final planting dates have either already passed or maybe they're coming up very quickly. For every day after May 15th, the corn is not in the ground, farmers lose approximately 2% of their yield. Unfortunately, more rain is on the way, and it looks like thousands of corn farmers will not be able to plant corn at all this year. So it is no exaggeration to say that what we are facing is a true national catastrophe. Now, he goes on and he talks about some numbers. He says, according to the Department of Agriculture, over the past 5 years, an average of 66% of all corn fields were already planted by now. Okay? 66% are usually planted by now. Now they have 30%. And it's lagging the 5-year average of 66%. Soybean crop was 9% planted, behind the 5-year average of 29%. Soybean farmers have a little bit more time to recover, but they are facing a little bit of a unique problem of their own. So let's just take a look at the corn planting numbers from Michael Snyder and from some of the most important corn producing states. And he says, I think you will agree that these numbers are almost too crazy to believe. In Iowa, 48% planted. The 5-year average, 76. Minnesota, 21% planted. 5-year average, 65%. North Dakota, 11% planted. 5-year average, 43%. South Dakota, 4%. 5-year average, 54%. What's this going to do to food prices, ladies and gentlemen? You know, the farmers, they want to plant, but the wet conditions have just made it impossible. This comes from ABC7 Chicago. And again, I'm still in the Michael Snyder because I want to give him a credit for doing such a great job putting these numbers together. This is from ABC within his article. This is ABC7 Chicago. McNeil grows corn and soybeans on more than 500 acres. But his farmland right now, as much of it is underwater and too wet to plant. And so there isn't much that he can do. Soil moisture levels in the state of Illinois are in the 90th to 90th, 99 percentile statewide. And basically, what you could say, the entire state is completely and utterly drenched. This is Illinois. As a result, very few Illinois farmers have been able to get their crops in the ground. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's crop progress reports, about 11% of Illinois corn has been planted and about 4% of soybeans. Last year at this time, 88% of corn and 56% of soybeans were in the ground. So Michael Snyder said he used the word catastrophe to describe what Illinois farmers are facing. But the truth is that what they are going through is far beyond that. If corn farmers have a problem getting corn in the ground, then they just switch to soybeans instead. But thanks to the trade war, soybean exports have plummeted dramatically. And the price of soybeans is the lowest that it's been in a decade. So as a result of this, there's very little profit. So, if the wet conditions persist, many soybean farms are not going to be able to plant crops at all. And sadly, global weather patterns are continuing to go a little bit haywire, and much more rain is coming. So, And you know, then you got to think of corn. Let's think about if this is all feeder corn that goes to the cattle, and can you imagine what that's going to happen to those prices? Because the feeder corn is going to be so expensive. They're not going to get enough money for the cattle to compensate for the higher cost in corn. I mean, this is what happens. And what happens at the grocery store? Those prices, you know, for those that can stay in business, they're gonna skyrocket. So it really has a, you know, I'm a pet peeve on trickle down. That's really does have a trickle down effect in many different ways. And you know, again, I'm not a farmer, and you know, this isn't my area of quote unquote expertise, but what I do know that it happens. And if this is feeder corn, the majority of probably is feeder corn, there's not going to be feed for the cattle, and it's going to get very, very expensive. And ranchers can't afford the additional costs, so they have to cut back their herds, which means they're getting less. So, Michael Snyder. And he says, even though I have been regularly documenting the nightmarish agricultural conditions in the middle of the country, the numbers in this article are much worse than he thought they would be at this point in 2019. He says, this is truly a major national crisis, and it is just getting started. So hold on to your seats, ladies and gentlemen. I hate to say this and bring this in at this a terrible time about rising costs for food and so forth, but it will be good for gold. You know, again, because anything with higher prices is not going to have good impacts on the economy. And so, again, we're seeing very difficult times that are facing this country. And you know, we talk about tariffs. We talked about the U.S. Did reach a deal to lift steel and aluminum tariffs on Canada and Mexico. I've been talking about this for a while. None of the countries could ratify the new agreement that President Trump put together for these three companies, basically updating the NAFTA agreement. And because both Mexico and Canada wanted these steel and aluminum tariffs eliminated until, or they would not ratify the agreement. So it's good to see that these are going to be lifted. In a joint statement on Friday, the Canadian and American governments said the U.S. will scrap the metals duties within 2 days. Canada will remove tariffs levied on American goods in retaliation for the steel and aluminum duties. The countries will also drop all pending litigation in the World Trade Organization related to the tariffs, set up measures to prevent the importation of aluminum or steel that is unfairly subsidized and/or at dumped prices, and also prevent the transshipment of aluminum and steel made outside of Canada or the United States to the other country. So, I guess this is a good thing. Now they'll be able to go forward and perhaps get this USMCA ratified. Again, I'm not sure what all the, you know, details are. We talk about them and so forth. There's some changes, but the biggest question is, and we're only going to find out. I mean, we can talk about good numbers, we can talk about bad numbers, we can talk of reality numbers, but until we actually see what happens from these changes in these trade agreements, you know, we really can't tell. Because, you know, just like AT&T, oh, you know, they're going to put so much money and they're going to hire so many people, and instead they end off laying off more and more. So I don't know why anybody believes when any, you know, politician, what any corporate CEO, when it comes to money and it comes to, I don't know why anybody would believe them right off the top of the. But anyway, that's just me. I want to see it before I believe it. But this is interesting. Ransomware. I haven't heard too many people talk about this, but Baltimore City enters its ninth day as city officials continue to say they can't say much about the investigation. The city council president, Brandon Scott, has called for a committee to look into the city's cybersecurity and its response to this attack. So they're being attacked. Hackers are demanding a ransom from Baltimore City and have warned the city would lose its data after 10 days. The deadline is today. So they said, I think if they delete data, we're going to be in a world of hurt. Baltimore cybersecurity firm Sashis is the CEO, said if the hackers have access to any backup systems, it could mean trouble. What is interesting, what has happened with this cyber attack is they have not been able to complete any real estate transactions. The ransomware struck citywide, but particularly the city finance department. Online billing remains down, as does the ability to close real estate transactions. No title searches, no lien certificates. So they talk about it has to get resolved. And I guess what they're requiring is three... let's see. The experts claim hackers demanded 13 bitcoins within 10 days, and that totals up to 100 grand. But that demand would keep going up would go up every day after 4 days. So it's fairly reasonable amount of money in the grand scheme of things to ask from a city. And you don't have any idea if that hacker is going to give you what you need after they're paid. So it looks like they're withholding the funds and waiting to see what's going to happen. How much money are going to spend to try to decrypt these passwords, and how much risk are they willing to take that the guy won't delete these files? So kind of interesting to follow, because we're not sure. I had no idea that they were actually holding up real estate transactions. No title searches, no lien. Although I did see later on in that article that they would hope the lien system would be up late next week. You know, that's the one they'll get up first. They want to put liens on all those people's properties that didn't pay their taxes. I don't know if that's true, but it's kind of interesting that that's the one that they had the most. they really want to get together. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. There's so much to talk about today, but we're just going to have to do it next week when we get back. And Fred's, the discount chain, they're closing 104 more stores this summer. Just thought I would throw that in. 800-375-4188. When I come back from break, you're going to be hearing James Corbett and myself. So I hope you enjoy our taping of that from Wednesday.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Back to Discount Gold and Silver Trading, Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the program after a little of a holiday, James Corbett. And as you know, James, I'm going to remind you, is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, which was founded in 2007. In 2012, he became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster, which, of course, was created by our good friend Bob Chapman. And you can visit James's website at thecorbettreport.com, thecorbettreport.com, and also you can request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster just by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Well, welcome back, James. Hello.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back.
And so we got lots of catching up to do. And you took a little bit of a holiday, and you went to Vietnam. And you wrote a recent article on the Corbett Report. And we have lots of things to talk about, but since you've been on holiday, your article is Law and Disorder, Even Tyranny Has Cracks. I don't know if it was inspired by your recent trip to Vietnam. The country is still a communist state. And in your article, you point out that it's not a typical military boots-on-the-ground dictatorship. Could you go on to describe how tyrannies like Vietnam operate, you know, in...
Yes. Yes, I can. In fact, this was inspired by a thought that was passed along by Brock West, who some people might know is my video editor for CorbettReport.com, and he lives in Vietnam now. He's Australian, but he's been living in Vietnam for over a year now, so I finally took him up on his offer and brought the family over to meet him and see the see a little bit of Vietnam. It was very nice to see another part of the globe. And one of the things that we talked about that he mentioned in passing while he was there is that, you know, there are, of course, there's lots of rules and laws and things that you're not supposed to do. But you know, as long as you're not causing trouble, generally there's not going to be too much of a police presence in your life. And that was an interesting statement because it corresponds to what I've found in a lot of different places that I've traveled to and lived in over the years, which is that, yeah, generally speaking, there, of course, there are a million different laws and rules and regulations and prohibitions wherever you go. But you get to know over time, well, some of them are more suggestions than they are real rules, and they're not really enforced and things like that. And we can all think of those types of things from our daily experience wherever we live. And that's one of the points of this article. I'm not talking about Vietnam specifically. I'm talking about any tyranny anywhere, because anytime some government claims to rule over you, I think that's some form of tyranny. But my point is that even such a trivial thing as, oh, you know, I broke the speed limit today, there's still a sense in which we all know, well, yes, that is a law, and you can and sometimes do get pulled over and ridden a fine or whatever it is for your infraction. But generally speaking, you know, you can get away with going a few miles an hour over the speed limit, kind of thing. It's that mentality, which is, I think, an important part to understand about the way that tyranny, or should I say government, I repeat myself, function. It creates this entire web of laws and rules and regulations and prohibitions that is so broad and so completely woven that all of us are enmeshed in it. And the old adage, I'm not sure, you know, to what extent this is literally true, but the old adage is that the average American commits 3 felonies a day without knowing it, because there are so many laws on the books that no one can even possibly keep up with them all, let alone understand them all. And some of them are just ridiculous. There's laws against putting lobsters in plastic bags in certain states and things like this that, again, people wouldn't even know they're committing a crime. And the point is, yes, this legal system has been created so that if and when the state really wants to crack down on you, they will have a million different excuses to do so, from the trivial to the not so trivial. But a lot of these rules that we all think, oh, you know, we're getting away with something, or we're kind of breaking a rule, or no one really follows that rule. Well, those rules are there for a reason, and generally it is so that the tyrant can assert his or her authority when they need to. And that's, I think that's the point. And it's something to keep in mind, because again, our image of tyranny, whether communist state or otherwise, is that it is that boots on the ground and everything is surveilled and rigorously enforced at all times. No, there are always cracks in every system, and they are deliberately left there, not only so that people feel like they're getting away with something, but they can be woven in that net at any time, but also because the deep state needs its own little back doors and loopholes in the system so that they can do their whatever it is, black money, black market money laundering or drug dealing or all the things we know that the deep state is involved in behind the scenes. Well, they need their agents to be involved in that as well. So there are those types of cracks in the system as well. And in a way, this is a kind of a double-edged sword. In one way, it's a good thing because it means that there is space and flexibility even in the seemingly harshest of dictatorships. It also means, on the flip side of that, that, if and when the technological surveillance state comes into play and we are constantly monitored and analyzed in real time and assigned a score, that makes that that leeway that we've enjoyed hitherto just that much less slack. So we're going to be feeling the noose around the neck a little bit more tightly as the technological police state comes into view.
You know, you talked about the way we're being watched. China, they just and I don't think this is the first one, but they have made a music video promoting the importance of integrity and trustworthiness. This is supposed to be, this video was released prior to rolling out their social credit system next year, and the system is designed to value and engineer better individual behavior, and they assign scores to their billion citizens. And in order to award the trustworthy and punish the disobedient. And, you know, so it's going to prevent those who are disobedient. You're not going to be able to travel. You won't be able to, you know, board trains. You won't be able to book hotels. I mean, these are just some of the penalties from the citizens that are deemed untrustworthy. With the amount of population that we have, is this going to come to a city near you, us, me?
Yes, yes. In a sense, it already is. It's just not in the same, it doesn't look and feel the same as it does in China right now. And yes, for people who haven't checked out that music video yet, I suggest they try to stomach it for at least a 30 seconds or a minute or so. You get the idea after that point. But yes, it is one of these creepy ways of trying to make everything seem glittery and poppy by putting some, you know, pop music over this exhortation for people to follow the rules and be trustworthy. Oh, yes, well, we should be trustworthy, but do we really want to enforce that with a social credit score? Of course not. But as creepy and Orwellian as that might seem to our perspective, most people in their everyday lives in the West will happily accept the fact that now Facebook is censoring people's political opinions and Twitter is telling people what they can or cannot say about even such things as human biology when it comes to touchy subjects like transgenderism and what have you. These types of things are now being essentially certain thoughts and certain ideas are being restricted from public comment at this point. And this is, of course, the catch-22, because people will say, oh, well, then what we need is we need the government to come in and regulate the big tech companies so that we can make it so that they all play fair and nicely, which I think is the worst type of utopian thinking, because it's not even the right type of thinking. I just recently elaborated on this in a video that is still on the front page of CorbettReport.com as we speak. Which is about big tech basically wanting to be regulated now. And Mark Zuckerberg came out and said as much in the last couple of weeks. He said that he's looking for government to come in and regulate political speech on social media platforms so that Facebook knows, you know, the rules and what to do and everything. And why do you think they are desiring this type of regulation? It's precisely because the types of laws and regulations that come in to try to keep the social media space contained are the types of basically hoops that large companies will be able to jump through because they have lawyers and accountants and compliance officers and teams of engineers that can do whatever they need to do, upload filters and what have you. But any competition to these big tech giants will be weeded out because they will not be able to live up to that compliance structure. And that's exactly why the big companies, of course, they desire regulation because they are the ones generally who are writing that regulation behind the scenes. And if people want historical examples of exactly that phenomenon, they can go back to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which I'm sure a lot of Americans probably read in their high school classes and probably forget. But it was turn of the 20th century novel about the meatpacking industry and the horrific abuses that were going on in that industry at that time in the Chicago stockyards and what have you. And it was basically kind of like a muckraking journalism, but in a fictional novel context. But it was clearly taken up as a cause by the public. And the outcry was so large that the government came in and said, okay, we're going to regulate the meatpackers to make sure that none of this kind of shenanigans happens again. And so what did they do? Of course, they create what ultimately ended up becoming the FDA and this regulatory compliance structure for the meatpackers to follow and inspections and what have you, which only the very largest of the meatpackers could possibly live up to. They were the only ones that were able to comply with all the regulations and things that were coming in, and thus the meatpacking industry became even further consolidated than it was when Upton Sinclair was writing about it, which was, of course, exactly what the big meatpackers wanted. So they were the ones actually desiring the regulations because, again, they knew it was going to work to their benefit. I think in the exact same way, big tech is desiring regulation because they know it's going to cement their monopolies. It's getting harder and harder for a would-be YouTube competitor upstart to start out these days precisely because YouTube is able to do all of these things that the government is going to ask it to do that the upstart is not going to be able to do. And that's, I think that's the point of all of this.
Well, since all these tech programs and so forth, you know, the Zuckerberg ones that regulated, but, I mean, aren't these global? Which country and what government would do the regulating?
Yeah, that's a very good point and one that isn't brought up enough because some of this is revolving around the new laws that have been passed by the EU Parliament, which is now going to have to be enacted in each of the different states. They're going to have to write laws that are more specific than the vague kind of generalities that the EU has just passed. But they pertain to copyright compliance and things on the internet. But one of the clauses that is generating a lot of interest is one that will require platforms, social media platforms like YouTube, to check they will be held liable for copyrighted material if it is uploaded to their platform. Now that's a change because at this point, if there is some sort of copyrighted material or what have you uploaded to a platform like YouTube, then once that situation is brought to the attention of the platform, then they have some sort of legal responsibility to comply, to take it down or to initiate a copyright process or what have you. But at this point, they're going to say, no, anything that is uploaded is your responsibility, the platform's responsibility. So people are looking at that and saying, well, now all of these, whatever they are, film criticism channels or parody channels or all these things that make use of copyrighted material but in a fair use way are not going to be able to do anything. Even music tutorials, like how to play this song kind of thing, will not be able to function because there's going to be upload filters put in place to make sure that nothing copyrightable is put on the platform. And in order to do that, it's basically just going to screen out all of the stuff. It's not going to consider fair use because at this point, YouTube, I know, actually generally doesn't consider fair use. It doesn't really comply to those laws. So the point is the EU is instituting these laws that's going to change and shape the social media space in general. And it's not like they're going to create a different YouTube or a different Facebook or a different Twitter for Europe. It's all going to be the same. They're just going to, it's the race to the bottom. Whichever countries or country brings in the most draconian legislation is probably going to be the one to influence the social media space this way or that way. And that's pretty disturbing because, again, it means it is a race to the bottom in terms of who can create the most draconian clampdown on the internet. Well, we're basically going to have to comply with that.
That is kind of, I mean, it brings in a whole bunch of questions, is because now you have a company that's basically being globally managed. I mean,
yeah,
it just kind
yeah,
of
yeah,
brings.
Yeah. No, it's a good point because.
It brings in this global one world order.
Of course, exactly. Yeah, because essentially that is what the internet is about. The internet is not a national entity. It is international, right. And it is bringing these issues to the fore because now we have to wonder. It's always been that kind of question in cyberspace. Well, what jurisdiction are we in if I post something to YouTube? I'm in Canadian in Japan. They're in California. You know, maybe it's a video I recorded in Vietnam. I don't know. Like, you know, what are the logistics here? What jurisdiction would be involved? Well, generally, these social media platforms and the other sites and things that you upload to will have some sort of thing in their legalese spiel that no one reads about, you know, we will settle things in this or that jurisdiction. But yeah, it does kind of raise all of these issues when we're talking about these international subjects. And then when you're talking about regulation and compliance, yeah, now we're talking about this completely new set of affairs that didn't really exist pre-internet in terms of this complicated structure that the average person is in their day-to-day life is going to be interacting with entities that are potentially all the way across the globe and all in all sorts of different places and going to be interacting with people across borders. In one way, this is a beautiful thing. This is humanity decentralizing and interacting with each other freely. But no, freely, that's the part that the powers that shouldn't be don't like. And that's why they're going to create various legal structures to get around this. And of course, it's going to have to be some sort of international thing because it's an international phenomenon that's taking place here. So we'll just have to bring in some sort of one world regulatory compliance for the internet structure. And on top of that, you know, maybe we can get a one world tax and we can start getting in all the other one world things. So it's a backdoor to globalism. And we're starting to see that play out as you very rightly point out here.
You know, I always said, everybody says, well, Y2K didn't happen, and yes, it did. I believe Y2K was all about wiring of the world together, and it just seemed, because everything has exploded after that. So many people got new computers and businesses and so forth. I mean, it was, you know, not that, you know, the world came to an end and the power went off and things like that, but if you really look and see what businesses and everyone did, we were wired together. And again, that was the starting point of here we are today. But anyway.
Well, on the bright side, I could just add that the Y2K that was supposed to happen here in Japan as we switched it to the year one with the new emperor didn't happen. As far as I can tell, the planes aren't falling from the skies and dogs aren't marrying cats. So I guess that was okay.
Well, that's really good, or we wouldn't be doing this program, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I wanted to talk to you about Abe and President Trump. And there's so many things I want to catch up. We need 5 hours today. I want to talk to you, James. But we don't have 5 hours. I only have a couple seconds as we're going into our break. We'll continue right after these short commercials. Please stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm joined with James Corbett.
Oh, won't you tell me again today?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. James, there's a lot of info in the news. For 3 days, for a week, there were really big headlines of trade wars. Totally gone today. We saw the stock markets correct down, 700 points one day, came back and so forth. So there's tweeting, tweeting is appropriate, but the stock market is going up and down and so forth. Is China going to use U.S. Treasuries we know their holdings are at a two-year low. Are they going to continue to use holdings against this trade deal, or is there something more to it, or Where do you see this trade war going between the United States and China?
Yeah, well, those are good questions, and I think you're right to point out that the headlines about the calamitous trade war did disappear rather quickly because, as you point out, the stock market corrected. It went back up. So we're fine, right? Because we have been trained, and this is a point that I've written about over and over in the Forecaster for years now, we've been trained to believe that the stock market is really a bellwether of the economy. And perhaps there was a time in which that was true, in which there was some sort of manufacturing growth or something was really reflected in those numbers. But at this point, those numbers are nothing but central bank manipulation, and they mean nothing. But we're still trained to believe that, oh, the stock market's going up, so I guess everything's okay, right? Or wrong. And we can tell that from various statistics, even from mainstream sources. The IMF's Direction of Trade statistics, for example, shows quite clearly that U.S. exports to the world are at their weakest since 2009. U.S. exports to advanced economies are also at their weakest since 2009, and U.S. exports to the European Union are just about at their lowest since 2009, which, why 2009? Oh, of course, that was the Lehman crisis, the start of the greatest recession, or whatever the history books are going to term that, basically financial crisis territory. As the headline on Zero Hedge is saying right now, global trade collapsing to depression levels. Yeah, that's about right. Global trade really is seizing up right now, and there is some serious ramifications that are not being priced in, or at least not reflected in those stock market numbers. So I think it is interesting how quickly those headlines did drop off. As to where this is heading, again, I don't have a crystal ball, and it is a question of what leverage China really has in these negotiations, because, of course, Trump is slapping 25% tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods, so China turns around and sanctions $60 billion worth of U.S. goods. Well, it's not really doesn't balance out, because China really can't do that, because they don't import as much American goods as America imports Chinese goods. So they don't have that kind of leverage in the system, in the situation. One of the leverages they do have is because of the trade deficit and the accumulation of dollars that China has accumulated over the years, and the treasuries that they are holding. They do have that leverage, and this is sometimes described as the Chinese nuclear option, that they're going to dump them all, or dump all the treasuries all at once and cause the dollar to crash or something. I've written about this before. I don't think that's even possible, let alone likely. I don't think China would be motivated to do that, because they are still trying to finance and leverage out their Belt and Road initiatives. And once that is in place, perhaps then they could afford to have something like the dollar collapse and some sort of big economic calamity because they'd be sitting pretty. But I don't think that's any time in the near future, and I don't think they're looking to do that right now. I think China, as usual, is probably playing the long game here and trying to basically maintain things to the extent that they can for as long as they can. And they'll, you know, as usual, as they're part of their trade negotiations, they'll say things and they'll promise things and then they'll renege on them later. And that's how these negotiations generally work. So it is an interesting process. Unfortunately, it's lose-lose for humanity because, of course, tariff is just a fancy way of saying tax on Americans for Chinese goods. So it's not like anyone really wins from this scenario. It's just that trade is shutting down and that's going to affect everyone. I guess the real question is, what are people doing to offset this or correct this? And of course, we have seen precious metals spiking a bit recently as a result of some of this uncertainty, as we would expect. Of course, precious metals always seen as a store of safety. We've also seen Bitcoin coming back. I actually haven't checked in the last couple of days, but it's been, I think, testing $6,000 or something at this point again, which, again, people will say, well, it was $20,000 a year and a half ago. Its all-time high was $20,000. It never ceases to amaze me that people are discount cryptocurrency because Bitcoin went from $20,000 to $3,500 or whatever. When a few years ago, if you said Bitcoin would ever get to $3,500, people would have laughed you out of the room. It'll never get there. So it's all a question of perspective, and it's always fascinating to me to see why and how people discount things and how they factor things like that in. But the point is, some people.
Let me just interject. Bitcoin is actually 8,300.
8,300. Well, there you go. You see, it is starting. It's every spring around April, it starts generally ramping up. And so it looks like this year it is doing the exact same thing. The only question is whether this will continue as a rally and test those previous highs or not. Whether it does or not, I think is ultimately inconsequential. It is still a relatively new market. It's only 11 years at this point since Bitcoin came into existence. But I think it's pretty safe to say that when you look at the overall trend line on a logarithmic scale, not on a arithmetical scale, but on a logarithmic scale, you can see that it is a generally smooth trend, except for these gigantic spikes and valleys that come, this huge rally and then huge crash that comes. But it ultimately returns to the trend line, and I think that's the point to keep in mind. But anyway, regardless of that as a sort of measured in U.S. dollars type of investment, I think the bigger question is it a store of value, and are people starting to flock to it as that? And some people are suggesting that this current rally might be a sign that, for example, China might be shoring up and investing a little bit in cryptocurrency as a way of hedging some of its bets. I don't think that's really likely in this case. A, as I say, it is a cyclical thing. It happens every spring. And B, I just don't think the cryptocurrency markets are large enough at this point for central banks to really be significantly hedging in there. But it is something to keep our eye on for the future, I would say.
When you talk about regulation, I heard a conversation on one of the media programs, financial programs, and someone was trying to blurt out that, 95% of the crypto market is not regulated, meaning nobody even has a clue in those exchanges on who has what, where it goes, where it's at, or anything. And they wouldn't let this person finish the statement. And I didn't realize it was that wild of a market. I mean, to where, people put money in and don't know where it goes.
Well, it has been a wild market. It has been a wild market. I think that is changing. And they are trying to clamp down on it various ways. And you certainly see this in the various exchanges that a few years ago even, most exchanges didn't require much identification and you could be exchanging different cryptocurrencies quite freely. It was generally harder to get cryptocurrency into cash, so that generally required some kind of identification. But there was lots of ways to take coins and shift them here and move them there. That is getting harder to do as more exchanges do enact their various know your customer type legislation, more wallets are being compliant and what have you. But there are still ways around that. And certainly there are exchanges where people can, and there are hundreds of different varieties of cryptocurrency now, and you can exchange between them in various ways. So yes, it is extremely, for the average person, it would be pretty much impossible. I still think that the NSA that has the trunk lines of the internet can probably do some pretty sophisticated blockchain monitoring to figure out what is what and where it's going and who's doing what. But still, that is top level deep state stuff. And, you know, generally the average person probably isn't in imminent trouble from that, but it's certainly something to think about. And the IRS and, of course, every other country's tax agency is looking at that as one big giant slice of pie that they can dig into once they get the tools to do so.
Well, you know, Saudi Arabia had two of its oil tankers were sabotaged off the coast of the UAE. They had drone attacks on an oil pumping station. And so my question is, are these false flags to drag us into a war with Iran? And is the United States, do you think the United States is willing to go to war with Iran? Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, the second question first, I would say yes, but that's a qualified yes. I mean, again, the United States is not an entity, but there are certainly elements right. in the Trump administration who are very keen to involve the U.S. in some, embroil the U.S. in some sort of war in the Middle East again. So we have to be concerned about that. And on that note, then, it is extremely important that people be very aware of the possibility of some sort of maritime false flag in the Persian Gulf, specifically in the Strait of Hormuz, which is absolutely crucial to shipping in the region. And it is a choke point, so it is definitely a place where certain things can be arranged and can happen. And we have to be aware that there is a very, very rich history of naval false flags being used to start various military operations going back hundreds of years. And I actually have written about this in an article that I wrote for The Forecaster a couple of years ago, U.S. Naval False Flags, A Brief History, where I just go through some of the examples throughout history that we've seen of incidents at sea being used to start wars, from the Spanish-American War to, of course, the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam and the Lusitania with World War One, and all of these other examples, including actually the interesting open letter that many people probably didn't see that Senator Gary Hart wrote, unsolicited advice to the government of Iran, where he wrote, presuming that you are not actually ignorant enough to desire war with the United States, you might be well advised to read the history of the sinking of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor in 1898 and the history of the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964. Having done so, you will surely recognize that Americans are reluctant to go to war unless attacked. Until Pearl Harbor, we were even reluctant to get involved in World War II. For historians of American wars, the question is whether we provoke provocations. Whether we provoke provocations, that's an incredible thing for a senator to be openly musing about. He is essentially saying, watch out, we can stage certain incidents, and you might be on the receiving end of whatever results from that. That's a pretty remarkable thing that I think a lot of people didn't pick up on at the time, so they can go back and read my article for the link to that. But it is absolutely something we have to keep in mind. I haven't seen enough information about these incidents in the Persian Gulf in the last couple of weeks, to be able to say one way or another whether this is or isn't a false flag or what really happened at all. We know there was some sort of sabotage attack off of Fujairah, which is part of the UAE, on May 12th, that involved four ships, two Saudi ships, an Emirati ship, and a Norwegian ship, which had holes blown in their hull near the waterline, but very few details. Of course, it was immediately blamed on Iran by America. And then on May 14th, there was two oil pumping stations that were attacked or damaged that Saudi Arabia is blaming on Yemen, or the Houthi rebels that they are slaughtering in Yemen. So there are a couple of incidents, but there's not a lot to go on. Of course, the finger has been blamed, pointed at Iran, but again, there's not even any evidence that they're pointing to. They're just saying it's Iran and expecting everyone to go along with it. Hopefully, we have educated the public enough that they're not just going to believe it just because, oh, well, the U.S. government is saying it's Iran. Well, then, good enough for me. Let's sign up and go to war. Hopefully, people will have a bit of skepticism about these events and not be in such a rush to get involved in a war. I mean, post-Iraq, post-Libya, post-Syria, post all of these debacles that have resulted over the last couple of decades from jumping into wars, I'm thinking maybe it's time to just put a little bit of a break on these operations. I would expect even the normiest of mainstream normies to be a little bit reluctant to jump into another war in the Middle East at this point. But unfortunately, logic does not always prevail in these situations.
Well, I guess they are removing folks out of the embassy in Iraq. And the U.S. embassy is being cleared. I guess they're leaving a few people back, but most of them are leaving or being brought back. And, you know, I think, yeah, I, personally, it's my own view, and it doesn't, you know, it's maybe I shouldn't say it, and I said it on the program, but I do believe we're going to be in a war somewhere before 2020. I just believe we are. And,
I'm afraid you might be correct about that. And one worrying sign of that, on May 9th, John Bolton, who of course is the neocon warmonger par excellence in the Trump administration, just updated plans for sending 120,000
yes.
troops to the Middle East
yes.
if Iran attacks. So they're definitely prepping for something at this point.
Yes, and I just, based on what's happening in D.C. and those behind it, yeah, there's no way we're, I just believe we are. And so, and it's a frightening thing because I remember Bob Chapman saying, no, because Iran, they know they're going to get blown to smithereens. So, you know, they don't want a war. And, which made sense at that point in time. But now you've got all these other countries positioning themselves. You know, China's become more powerful since then. You have Russia. You see these other relationships that I think makes Iran a whole lot larger than what it used to be.
Yeah.
As far
yeah.
as
threat. And there are people who have been saying who do say, well, you've been talking about this for a decade now or a decade and a half, and it hasn't happened yet. The war in Iran. Well, yeah, you keep talking about it until it happens, and we certainly know that this is a desire of the neocon set. We've known
yes.
that for years. So, and here we go.
Oh my gosh, we're out of time. That went by quick. Thank you so much. I was looking so forward to spending this time with you, James, and we'll talk again in 2 weeks. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival. Thank you for joining us. So be safe, good night, and God bless.